All right. Where are you? All right. Let's go ahead and begin our brisk run through the book of Deuteronomy. All right, starting last session, we were talking about Deuteronomy 6, verse 4, you shall love the Lord with all your heart and soul and mind and strength. And as we looked at that area, we began to look at the obligations on the person. And this was the source of the wearing the head and arm tefillin. We talked about that. And now we're moving to discuss the obligation in regard on the home. So we had the obligation on the person in verse 8. And now we're in Deuteronomy 6, verse 9, and the obligations on the home. Okay, everybody there? All righty. Let's go ahead and start with verse 9. And you shall write them upon the doorposts of your house. So the commandments of the Lord are to be obeyed in your home personally and upon your gates. That's the gates of the city. And so the commandments need to be obeyed in the greater community as well. And this is the basis, this command is the basis for the mezuzah, the parchment containing two passages. Now here is a mezuzah, you see them all over camp. They come in all kinds of designs. Literally the word means doorpost. And it's a small decorative container affixed to the right doorpost upon entering of the house and rooms in the Orthodox Jewish homes. It contains Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 9 and Deuteronomy 11, 13 through 21 on small parchments. And the purpose for affixing the mezuzah is to serve as a symbol, a reminder of the need to constantly remember God and to teach and obey His law and to love Him, especially during times of prosperity. So that's where the practice of the mezuzah that you see in all our doors comes from. Then as we get into chapter 6, verse 10, there's a warning against forgetfulness. We begin with the blessings on the land in chapter 6, verse 10a, first part of the verse. And it shall be when the Lord your God shall bring you into the land which he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So the timing is after the conquest of the land. To give you great and goodly cities which you did not build. So most of the cities will not be destroyed, but will be occupied intact. The Terem curse, remember we saw that in Joshua, is only on the people, not on the structures. So the structures are still intact, but they're empty. Verse 11. Houses full of good things, which you did not fill. Cisterns hewn out, which you did not hew. That's water storage, underground water storage. Vineyards and olive trees, which you did not plant. You shall eat and be full. So Israel is going to get a ready-made country, a ready, instant city. So God will prosper them in the land. But this prosperity is conditioned on obedience. And the danger is forgetting the source and the reason for the prosperity. So we now come to verse 12 and the danger. Beware lest you forget the Lord who brought you forth out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, out of the slavery. So wealth so easily acquired could easily lead to forgetfulness about the source. So in verse 13, we come to a positive obligation. You shall fear the Lord your God. Him shall you serve. That means to worship and obey him. You shall swear by his name. Now this is not a command to take an oath. However, if an oath is taken, or must be taken for some reason, it must only be in the name of the Lord, no other God. That would be an expression of loyalty to the true God. And if you take an oath, it's not to be done in vain. Not casually or flippantly. It must be fulfilled. Verse 14. The negative obligation. You shall not go after other gods. The gods of the peoples that are round about you. So all foreign gods are forbidden to Israel. Israel's main danger will be to be influenced by the idolatry of the surrounding nations. In verse 15, we get the reason for all this, the jealousy of God. For the Lord your God in the midst of you is a jealous God. Now this is jealousy in the good sense, exercising the right of possession, you know, protecting your valuables, the thing that belongs to you and that is important to you. For the Lord your God in the midst of you is a jealous God, lest the anger of the Lord your God be kindled against you and he destroy you from off the face of the earth. And this does not mean Israel be annihilated from the earth, simply removed from the promised land. In verse 16, we come to the warning against tempting God. You shall not tempt the Lord your God. Tempting God implies a lack of confidence in God. So don't challenge him. Don't challenge him to prove something. That's tempting God. This is a consequence of forgetting the past acts of God. And you know, Jesus quoted this verse when tempted, Matthew 4:7 and Luke 4:12. Jesus said unto him, again it is written, you shall not make a trial of the Lord your God. All right, verse 16. As ye tempted him at Massah, this is a reference back to Exodus 17, verses 1 through 7. It's a result of forgetting the miracles of the Exodus. So in light of all this, in verse 17, we have Israel's obligations. You shall diligently keep the commandments of the Lord your God and his testimonies and his statutes which he commanded you. Verse 18. And you shall do that which is right and good in the sight of the Lord. To do what is right and good means to keep his commandments. And why? That it may be well with you, and that you may go in and possess the good land which the Lord swore to your fathers. Verse 19. To thrust out all your enemies from before you, as the Lord has spoken. So testing God is an act of disobedience. So now we come in verse 20 to an exhortation to remember and to teach. We start in verse 20. The occasion. When your son asks you in the time to come, so this is how the covenant is going to be transmitted from generation to generation. When he asks you in the time to come, saying, when your child asks, what mean the testimonies and statutes, the ordinances which the Lord our God has commanded you? Verse 21 is your response. Then you shall say unto your son, and they will tell the story of the bondage then. You'll say unto your son, we were Pharaoh's bondmen in Egypt. And then they'll tell the children that this servitude has been changed from Pharaoh to God. We are now God's vassals. And so that's the facts you teach, that the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. In verse 22, the judgment of God is explained. And the Lord showed signs and wonders, great and sore, upon Egypt, upon Pharaoh, upon all his house, before our eyes. So the Jewish people are to, or the generation is to share that they were eyewitnesses to the Exodus. So the purpose of God for all this, he brought us out from thence, out from Egypt, for the purpose of giving Israel the promised land, that he might bring us in to give us the land, which he swore to our fathers. And of course, this is the Abrahamic covenant. Now, why did God bring us into the land? There are two reasons. Verse 24. Number one, first reason is for our prosperity. And the Lord commanded us to do all these statutes. That's your external behavior. To fear the Lord your God. That's our internal attitude. And the purpose? For our good always. For our good always. Our prosperity. And also for our preservation, that he might preserve us alive as at this day. The fact that the parent is alive to answer the son's question is evidence that God has fulfilled his purpose. So that's the first reason that God brought us into the land. When we get to verse 25, we come to the second reason, for their righteousness. It shall be righteousness unto us. If we obey the law, we'll be conforming to a standard. God's standard of behavior will be observed. If we observe to do all this commandment before the Lord our God as he has commanded us. So internal righteousness, faith, will produce external righteousness, signified by the keeping of the law. So internal faith will produce obedience. Now, as we get to chapter 7, we come to a warning against idolatry and intermarriage. In verse 1, we start with a comment about the conquest. When the Lord your God shall bring you into the land, whither you go to possess, and shall cast out many nations from before you, and then he begins to list the nations, the Hittite, the Girgashite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite, seven nations. Now, that's not an exhaustive list. There are other lists of Canaanite nations, up to 12 in other lists. But their status, they are greater and mightier than you. Greater in numbers, mightier in strength. And this is why Israel's going to need divine help. So in verse 2, we come to the law of extermination. And when the Lord your God shall deliver them up before you, you shall smite them, you shall utterly destroy them. This is the Harem curse. Now, what's the justification for the curse? We've heard about this from Arnold a number of times. First of all, it was divine judgment upon them for their wickedness, which included child sacrifice. It included cultic prostitution. And they persisted in their hatred of God without repentance. Thirdly, they would have been a moral cancer to Israel. Israel needed to be protected from Canaanite depravity. And they ignored grace. They were given 400 years to change and did not. So now we come in verse 2 to the prohibition of interrelationships in two ways. First of all, in verse 2b, don't make covenants with them. You shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy unto them. And then in verses 3 and 4, no marriage. Neither shall you make marriages with them. Your daughter you shall not give unto his son, nor his daughter shall you take for your son. And the reason is in verse 4, for he will turn away your son from following me, that they may serve other gods. And so the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will destroy you quickly. So what's the response Israel has? The obligation Israel has is the destruction of idolatry. But thus shall you deal with them. You shall break down their altars. Those are structures on which pagan offerings were placed. You'll dash in pieces their pillars. Their pillars were like obelisks. Their stones, they had stones, both cut and uncut, used for worship purposes. They were often engraved with images of gods and goddesses. Sacrifices were offered to them. So they represented the male procreative symbol and fertility rites. You will hew down their asherim. These were sacred trees or posts, wooden objects of worship. They represented the goddess Asherah. This was the deity responsible for fertility in the Canaanite religions. Burn their graven images with fire. Burn their idols of all kinds. Destroy them. So what we have here is complete and total religious intolerance is commanded. A little different from the way our culture is going, isn't it? All these involve sensual worship and included male and female prostitutes. And here's a couple of examples. Here's a drawing of standing stones that are Hazor. And you can see they're carved in the images of deities and symbols carved upon them. So these are standing stone type of images. And here's some altar and a pillar found at Shechem and Megiddo. Destroy them all. Destroy them all. And then Israel's covenant relationship is emphasized in verse 6. Israel is the chosen people. For you are a holy people unto the Lord your God. This is the basis for the previous command of extermination and separation. You're a holy people. Israel is to be a holy nation. And the definition of holy, basically, is to be separated from the ordinary and consecrated for a special purpose. So Israel is to be unique and different and to serve God. And the object, you have been chosen to be a people under the Lord your God. And the reason the Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for his own possession. Remember now, God chose Israel. It was not Israel choosing God. And this phrase, a people for his own possession, is Am Segula. It means a treasured people, literally, a treasured people. The word is used of a private accumulation of somebody, something that is cherished, something that is personally valued. So God cherishes Israel because of his personal stake in her. His stake in her comes through the covenants. This is why he expresses jealousy for her. Israel is very important to him. Israel is his treasured people. And then the comparison. You are my own possession above all the peoples on the face of the earth. And God had plenty to choose from. But he sovereignly chose Israel. And so Israel alone has the status of chosen people. Now the basis of the choice comes out in verses 7 and 8. Verse 7, it was not on the basis of merit. The Lord did not set his love on you, nor choose you, because you were more in number than any people, for you were the fewest of all the peoples. The nation was only about 2 million, so it's considered to be a small nation. So there's nothing meritorious in Israel that caused God to make his choice. Verse 8. But because the Lord loved you, and because he would keep the oath he swore unto your fathers, because of the Abrahamic covenant, God promised to choose the nation that came out of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so the act, Jehovah has brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of bondage, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Then the attributes of God are listed in verse 9. Know therefore that the Lord your God, he is God, so he's unique and he's all-powerful, the faithful God, who keeps covenant and loving kindness with those that love him and keep his commandments to 1,000 generations. So he is unique and powerful and faithful. He will fulfill his covenant promises. And verse 10, the other side of the coin comes to light. And repays them that hate him to their face, to destroy them. He will not be slack to him that hates him. He will repay him to his face. So God is merciful and loving and dependable, but he also has another side. He's also a lion. He will also judge. Now Israel's obligation in light of this is in verse 11. You shall therefore, because of all this, you shall therefore keep the commandment, the statutes, the ordinances, which I command you this day to do them. And in verse 12, the blessings of obedience come to the fore. And it shall come to pass, because ye hearken unto these ordinances, to keep and do them, that the Lord your God will keep with you the covenant. He will fulfill the Abrahamic covenant to Israel. But if this generation wishes to experience blessing, they need to be obedient. He will keep the covenant and the loving kindness, the faithfulness of God, which he swore unto your fathers, and he will love you and bless you and multiply you. And then the blessings are explained in verse 13. First blessing is fruitfulness. He will also bless the fruit of your body, that's children, human procreation, the fruit of your ground, your grain, your new wine, your oil, that's agricultural blessings. The increase of your cattle and the young of your flock, that's the animal blessings, economic blessings. And the place in the land which you swore unto your fathers to give them, to give you. In verse 14, you shall be blessed above all peoples. There shall not be a male or female barren among you or among your cattle. So Israel is going to be unique in her health and in her population increase, in her prosperity. And verse 15 focuses in on that physical health, that second blessing in verse 15. The Lord will take away from you all sicknesses. None of the evil diseases of Egypt, which you know, will he put upon you, but he will lay them upon all them that hate you. Well, those are great blessings, but Israel has an obligation in order to receive them, in order to experience them. And you shall consume all the peoples that the Lord your God shall deliver unto you. Your eyes shall not pity them. neither shall you serve their gods. For that would be a snare unto you. This would lead to Israel's ruin. So Israel must be obedient. And Israel must be obedient in holy war, verse 17. Now if you say in your heart, these nations are more than I. Now back in verse 6, Moses told them that they were the fewest in number. And now the danger is that Israel might panic due to the Canaanite superiority and numerical strength. You may say in your heart, these nations are more than I. How can I dispossess them? Now this fear is generated by unbelief and by doubt. And the solution is to remember and have faith in God's power. Verse 18. You shall not be afraid of them. You shall remember what the Lord your God did unto Pharaoh, unto all Egypt. Verse 19. The great trials which your eyes saw, the signs, the wonders, the mighty hand, the outstretched arm, whereby the Lord your God brought you out. So shall the Lord your God do unto all the peoples of whom you are afraid. So what God did in Egypt, he's going to do again in Canaan. Therefore, there's no need to fear the superiority of the Canaanite numbers. And in verse 20, some divine assistance is described. Moreover, the Lord your God will send the hornet among you. Now, there's some debate as to what this term hornet means. There's a few optional interpretations. It could be literal, meaning a plague of hornets or wasps, something like that. A ferocious swarm of hornets would hunt down the Canaanites and sting them to death or drive them out. However, there's no record of any kind of a literal fulfillment of a literal prophecy there. It could be metaphorical. The hornet is a terror so powerful and persistent that it would search out and destroy even those that hide themselves. Or it could be symbolic of God himself. Now, in light of verses 22 through 24, this seems to be the best position. God is in the midst of you, a great God and terrible. And this comment, terrible, is in the sense of awe-inspiring power. A sense of awe-inspiring exhibition of power. Now, even though God will remove the Canaanites, he's not going to remove them all at once, instantly. He's going to remove them gradually, we learn in verse 22. Before you, a little and little. You may not consume them at once. Why? Lest the beasts of the field increase upon you. So the number of Israelites at this moment are too few to be able to occupy the land all at once. The unoccupied land would be overrun by wild animals. And so the conquest will be gradual, but it will be sure. They'll gradually grow. The animals will gradually back away as the human habitation takes over. Verse 23. The population, though, needs to be exterminated. But the Lord your God will deliver them up before you and will discomfit them with great discomfiture. The discomfiture just means confusion. Your translation might run it that way. He will confuse them with a great confusion until they be destroyed. In addition, the kings will be eliminated. And he will deliver their kings into your hand, and you shall make their names perish from under heaven. And there shall no man be able to stand before you until you've destroyed them. And we've already looked at the fulfillment in Joshua 12 with the list of 31 kings that were killed by Joshua. And then Israel is to destroy idolatry as we get into verse 25. The graven images of their gods you'll burn with fire. You shall not covet the silver or gold that is on them. You know, don't even strip off the silver and gold before you destroy the idol. Don't take it with you. It may be tempting, but don't do it. Destroy the whole idol. And the reason? Lest you be snared by them. For this is an abomination unto the Lord your God. It is a religiously detestable action to save any part of an idol. Any part of an idol. And so that word abomination expresses God's revulsion at idols. Idols are repugnant to God. And in verse 26, the harem curse is mentioned. You shall not bring an abomination into your house or become a devoted thing like unto it. Don't bring it into your house because you'll become like it. The point is that the person himself will fall under the harem curse and be totally devoted to destruction if they keep any part of that idol. You shall utterly detest it. You shall utterly abhor it, for it is a devoted thing. It's totally devoted to destruction. Get rid of it. Now, as we get to chapter 8, verse 1, we come to a warning against forgetfulness. Now, I'd like to just point out the chiastic instruction of chapter 8 for you. We've mentioned this in the introductory material, but let's give you a look at it, how it works here. The chapter is organized around the danger of prosperity. So let's look at this chiastic instruction, this instruction that looks like an X or a key. Verse 1, Israel is to obey and prosper. Verses 2 through 5 discusses the wilderness and the manna God provided for Israel. Verses 6 through 10 encourages Israel to obey during prosperity. Verses 11 through 14 say, do not forget God during prosperity. See, prosperity is emphasized here. Then we go back in verses 15 and 16. There's a discussion of the wilderness and the manna. And then back in verses 17 through 20, remember or perish. So the chapter is organized around the danger of prosperity. That's the emphasis. Obey during prosperity. So there are two themes in chapter 8. First one is remembrance, that is, obedience brings blessing, and forgetfulness, disobedience brings discipline. All right. So God's past provisions come to light in verses 8, in chapter 8, verses 1 through 5. In verse 1, Israel's obligation and reward. The obligation. All the commandments which I command you this day, you shall observe to do. And the motivation is blessings. That ye may live, remember that refers to physical life, and multiply, you'll increase in number, and possession of the land will be the result. Go in, conquer the land, possess the land, own your land, which the Lord swore unto your fathers. And in verse 2, he recalls the wilderness wanderings. And you shall remember. You shall remember three items. Item number 1, in verse 2, the 40 years of testing. You shall remember all the way which the Lord your God led you these 40 years in the wilderness. And the purpose was a fourfold testing. Number 1, that he might humble you. To prove you. To know what was in your heart. Whether you would keep his commandments or not. Now there are two reasons for the wilderness and wanderings. The first one was to punish the Exodus generation that was so rebellious and stubborn. But the second reason is to test and train and mature the wilderness generation. So the first thing you should remember is the 40 years of testing. Item number 2 is the provision God brought forward in verse 3. He humbled you. How did he humble Israel? By forcing them to trust in God, that he would provide. And how did he do this? He humbled thee and suffered thee to hunger and fed you with manna, which you knew not, neither your fathers know. Now, what is manna? I got a kick out of the definition that was written up in the JPS Torah commentary by T.G. Here's what T.G. says. According to Exodus, the term essentially means, whatchamacallit. The Israelites called it this because when they first saw it, they asked, what is it? The very name thus expresses its unprecedented character. What is it? Nobody really knows, down to this day. Chapter 8, verse 3. The lesson, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord does man live. Sound familiar to you? Yeah, you've read it in Matthew and Luke. from Yeshua's mouth during his temptations. But he answered and said, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. That's the full quote. And Luke gives us an abbreviated quote. And Yeshua answered unto him, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone. All right, item number three to remember is God's provision of clothing in verse 4. Your raiment waxed not old upon you, the shoes, neither did your foot swell. Now that last reference there, that last phrase is either a reference to healthy feet or it's a reference to sandals that don't wear out. Both are necessary for walking through the desert, aren't they? And the duration, these 40 years. Israel didn't have what do you ladies do? You always wear different, what's the word I'm looking for? Style. You know, there was no style changes. All right, verse 5. Verse 5, the divine discipline. You shall consider in your heart that as a man chastens his son, so the Lord your God chastens you. So the discipline in the wilderness came out of a father-son relationship. Now as we get into verse 6, God's future provisions come in view. First of all, Israel's obligation. You shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God to walk in his ways and to fear him. Verse 7, where shall you do this? In the promised land. For the Lord your God brings you into a good land, and it's good for three reasons. First of all, in verse 7, it's a land of water, a land of brooks of water. Those are wadis. Wadis are dry in the summer, but they're filled with water during the rainy season. So this is a seasonal water source. It's a land of fountains and springs. These are perennial water sources, flowing in the valleys and the hills. So it's a land of water. Verse 8, it's a good land, a land for crops, a land of wheat and barley. Two kinds of grains are mentioned. Then five kinds of fruits, vines and fig trees and pomegranates and olive trees and honey. And honey refers to date honey, date palms. And these crops still thrive in Israel today. Here's a Jezreel Valley wheat field and a thriving vineyard in Israel these days. These crops are very, very thrive in Israel. Fig tree in Dan. Pomegranates. Here's some olive trees in Upper Galilee. You'll see all this when you go to Israel. And down in the Arabah, there's date palms. All these crops flourish in this land. In verse 9, it's also a land of food and minerals. A land wherein you shall eat bread without scarceness. That's prosperity. And you shall not lack anything in it. That's abundance. And then the minerals are brought forth. A land whose stones are iron. And out of whose hills you may dig copper. And that copper came out of the copper mines in the Timnah Valley. You can visit those when you go to Israel. Now what's the proper attitude toward all these blessings? Verse 10. And you shall eat and be full, and you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land that he's given you. So the correct response to the prosperity of the land should be to remember God and to thank him. That's all he needs. That's all he wants is thanks. The wrong response would be forgetfulness. So the danger of forgetfulness now comes to the forefront in verse 11. Beware lest you forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his ordinances, his statutes, which I command you today. For the danger is disobedience, either active disobedience, such as idol worship, or passive disobedience, such as forgetfulness. Verse 12. Lest when you have eaten and are full and have built godly houses and dwelt therein, verse 13, and when your herds and your flocks multiply and your silver and your gold is multiplied and all that you have is multiplied, in other words, you're filthy rich, verse 14, the problem, then your heart be lifted up. Your prosperity will lead to pride and you will assume that you did it on your own. Arrogance. And the result, you shall forget the Lord your God. And there's four descriptions of God given. First, who brought you forth out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. He's the God of the Exodus. Verse 15. Second, who led you through the great and terrible wilderness, wherein were fiery serpents and scorpions, and thirsty grounds where there was no water. So God is a God of preservation. Third, who brought you forth water out of the rock, the flint. God is a God of provision. He's a God of where did I see that here? Well, anyway, now he's a God of provision, because water is a basic necessity. And fourthly, in verse 16, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers knew not. He's a God of sustenance, of food, another basic provision. And the purpose? That he might humble thee, that he might prove you. The goal? To do you good in the latter end. To do you good. But then he brings forth Israel's faulty conclusion, something that's going to happen in the future now. And lest you say in your heart, my power, the might of my hand, has gotten me this wealth. Pride in wealth, arrogance. Now, in a little different context, I'd like to share with you that this is still our problem. This fellow's named Moshe. He's on an El Al flight with me when I was leading one of my tours to Israel. And there was a confusion in seats, and the seat beside me was empty. He got plopped down, and at the very last instant, he and his wife got on the plane and had to sit in different locations. But Moshe spoke English very well, and we got to talking. And I learned that he had fought in just about every one of Israel's wars. So I said to him, Moshe, I think God protected us through those wars. And here's his answer, word for word. He looked at me and he said, there is no God. We did it. We have the power. He's forgotten about his God. That's the problem. Moshe has pride in military victory and power. And we forget God. Verse 18. Verse 18. Israel's obligation. But you shall remember the Lord your God. For it is he that gives you power to get wealth. It doesn't come from human activity. And the goal, that he may establish his covenant, which he swore unto your fathers, as it is this day. Israel's presence in the land will confirm that covenant. So the prosperity was a confirmation of the covenant relationship, and the covenant relationship was the source of their blessing. We come to verse 19 and the threat of judgment again. And it shall be that you shall forget the Lord your God and walk after other gods and serve them and worship them. I testify against you this day that you shall surely perish. And again, he's speaking of exile there. Exile out of the land. The inability to enjoy the blessings of the land. And there's a comparison in verse 20. As the nations that the Lord makes to perish before you, so ye shall perish, because you shall not hearken unto the voice of the Lord your God. As we get into chapter 9, now we come to a story of two tablets. We begin in verse 1 with a call. Hear, O Israel. The phrase calls attention to something special, something significant. And in this case, the coming conquest. You are to pass over the Jordan this day and go in to dispossess nations greater and mightier than yourself, cities great and fortified up to heaven. Verse 2. A people great and tall, the sons of the Anakim, whom you know, of whom you have heard say, who can stand before the sons of Anak? And of course, the answer to that question is, you can, because God is with you. Now, this is an example of the human side coordinating with the divine side. The human side is to obey. The divine side is enablement in verse 3. Know therefore this day that the Lord your God is he who goes over before you as a devouring fire. He will destroy them He will bring them down before you. Then we jump back to the human side again. So you shall drive them out and make them perish quickly. The basis, as the Lord has spoken unto you. So the pattern here is obedience, faith, obedience, enablement, and then success. Faith, obedience, enablement, and then success. And there's some reasons for this divine enablement. First in verse 4, the negative side, speak not you in your heart, after that the Lord your God has thrust them out from before you, saying, so don't think this in your heart, for my righteousness the Lord has brought me to possess this land. Remember, Israel had no merit. Then positively, in the second part of the verse, whereas for the wickedness of these nations, the Lord does drive them out from before you. Do not go in, verse 5. Not for your righteousness, nor for the uprightness of your heart, do you go in to possess their land. But for the wickedness of these nations, the Lord your God does drive them out from before you. And that he may establish the word which the Lord swore unto your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob. And then verse 6. Know therefore that the Lord your God gives you not this good land to possess it for your righteousness, for you are a stiff-necked people. And that isn't something passive. It was active rebellion. So the conquest is not due to Israel's righteousness or Israel's merit. The conquest was due to two reasons: the wickedness of the nations and the Abrahamic covenant. So this admonition encourages a true attitude of trust in God. It's a warning against self-righteousness with an emphasis on divine power and faithfulness. And now Moses comes to the point where he reminds them of the sin of the golden calf. In verse 7. The admonition. Remember, forget you not how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness from the day you went forth out of the land of Egypt until you came unto this place, the plains of Moab. This is 40 years later. You have been rebellious against the Lord. Rebellion has been a characteristic base of Israel throughout the 40 years. So it reaffirms the fact of our stubbornness. See, this was written by God, not by man. No man would write this about his own family, would he? God is very honest here. It sometimes hurts, but he's very honest. Verse 8. The beginning at Mount Sinai, also in Horeb, you provoked the Lord to wrath. So this is a reminder of the past failure at Sinai with the golden calf. The Lord was angry with me to destroy you. Verse 9, the timing. When I had gone up into the mountain to receive the tables of stone, even the tables of the covenant which the Lord made with you, then I abode in the mount 40 days and 40 nights, and I did neither eat bread or drink water. And the point here is that the nation took advantage of Moses' long absence to commit a very great sin. Moses then receives the tablets of the law. And the Lord delivered unto me two tablets of stone, written with the finger of God. On them was written according to all the words which the Lord spoke to you on the mount, out of the midst of the fire, on the day of the assembly. So what God spoke publicly is now recorded on the tables of stone. Verse 11, he receives the tablets. And it came to pass at the end of 40 days and 40 nights that the Lord gave me the two tablets of stone, even the tables of the covenant. Verse 12, God's declaration. And the Lord said unto me, arise, go down quickly from hence. Why? For your people that you brought forth out of Egypt have corrupted themselves. God calls Israel your people. Normally, it would be my people whom I brought out of Egypt. Verse 12. They have quickly turned aside out of the way which I commanded them. They have made them a molten image. So the nation had immediately fallen into idolatry. Verse 13. Furthermore, The Lord spoke unto me, saying, I have seen this people. Behold, it is a stiff-necked people. And then in verse 14 comes the threat. Let me alone. Now that phrase implies that Moses could intercede successfully for the people. In fact, God wants him to do so. And he did. Let me alone that I may destroy them and blot out their name from under heaven. And I will make of you a nation mightier and greater than they. But God says, I will make a new nation reckoned after Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Moses. He's testing Moses. He's testing his pride. What's going to be the response of Moses? First of all, he breaks the tablets in verse 15. So I turned and came down from the mount, and the mount was burning with fire. So even with the Shekinah glory burning at the top of the mountain, the people embarked on this great sin. And the two tablets of the covenant were in my two hands. You know, what was written on those tablets? You shall not make a graven image and worship it. Isn't that ironic? And in verse 16, the sin. I looked, and behold, ye sinned against the Lord your God. You had made you a molten calf, and you had turned quickly aside out of the way which the Lord had commanded you. Verse 17, the breaking of the tablets. And I took hold of the two tables and cast them out of my hands and broke them before your eyes. So there's a legal significance here. This marked the annulment of the covenant. Relationships between God and Israel were severed. And then comes the intercession. Moses intercedes. He passes the test, doesn't he? Verse 18. And I fell down before the Lord as at the first 40 days and 40 nights. I did neither eat bread or drink water because of all your sin which you sinned in doing that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, to provoke him to anger. Verse 19, the emotions of Moses. For I was afraid of the anger and the hot displeasure wherewith the Lord was wroth against you to destroy you. But the Lord hearkened unto me that time also. So he's prayed for the nation. In verse 20, he also prayed for Aaron. And the Lord was very angry with Aaron to destroy him. But I prayed for Aaron also at that same time. And in verse 21, the calf is destroyed. And I took your sin, the calf which you had made, and burned it with fire, and stamped it, grinding it very small, until it was as fine as dust. And I cast the dust therefore into the brook that descended out of the mount. Now, according to Exodus 32:20, Moses also made the people drink of that water. This is similar to the ordeal of a suspected adulterous wife in Numbers 5, verses 11 through 31. And the parallel is that Israel is the wife of the Lord. So it's a very interesting parallel, that's for sure. Now, in verse 22 through 24, he jumps to Kadesh Barnea and other provocations. You provoked the Lord to wrath at Taberah. This is in Numbers 11, verses 1 through 3. Israel complained following some unspecified blessing, and a fiery judgment of burning followed. At Massah, this is a reference to Exodus 17, 1 through 7, where we complained about the lack of water and tested God. At Kibrot Hatta'avah, in Numbers 11, 4, in spite of the provision of manna, Israel lusted for the food of Egypt, and God sent quail. And many were choked to death on the quail as they gobbled it down. Then we come to verse 23 in Kadesh Barnea. And when the Lord sent you from Kadesh Barnea, saying, go up and possess the land which I have given you, then you rebelled against the commandment of the Lord your God. You believed him not, nor hearkened to his voice. So we participated in a full-scale rebellion. Numbers 13 and 14. Verse 24 is the summary. You have been rebellious against the Lord your God from the day I knew you. And the point is, the golden calf is not an isolated incident. It's not just a blip on the righteousness scale. In verses 25 through 29, Moses resumes talking about his 40 days and nights of prayer, the intercession. Verse 25. So I fell down before the Lord the 40 days and the 40 nights that I fell down. The reason? Because the Lord had said he would destroy you. Verse 26 is the prayer. And I prayed unto the Lord and said, first of all, he prayed on the basis of what God had already done for Israel. So the first request, O Lord God, destroy not your people and your inheritance. Notice how he's emphasizing God's personal relationship to Israel. He's kind of arguing with God there, isn't he? He's got a lot of courage, I think. The basis that you have redeemed through your greatness, that you have brought forth out of Egypt with a mighty hand. Verse 27. His second basis is the Abrahamic covenant. Remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Remember, God promised to make a nation from the patriarchs, not from Moses. Look not unto the stubbornness of this people, nor to their sin. That's the second basis, the Abrahamic covenant. The third basis is verse 28, God's reputation. Lest the land from where, lest the land whence you brought us say, lest Egypt, let the Egyptians say, because the Lord was not able to bring them out into the land which he promised them, lest the Egyptians say you are weak, because he hated them. In other words, God doesn't love Israel. The Egyptians might say, he brought them out to slay them in the wilderness. They might say that you're untrustworthy and deceptive. You don't love Israel. You're weak. And that would defame God's reputation. The fourth basis, verse 29. Yet they are your people, your inheritance, which you brought out by your great power and your outstretched arm. So again, he's emphasizing God's relationship with Israel. God is Israel's father. And then the second set of tablets comes into view in verse 10, chapter 10, verse 1. At that time the Lord said unto me, hew you two tablets of stone like unto the first. So God provided the first set, but Moses will provide the second set. Come up unto me unto the mount and make you an ark of wood. So he made a wooden box, a wooden chest. Verse 2. I will write on the tables the words that were on the first table that you broke, and you shall put them in the ark, in the box. And this shows us that God has forgiven Israel, and the covenant's been renewed. Verse 3. So I made an ark of acacia wood. So this may have been a temporary box before the one that the artist Bezalel made. And I hewed out two tablets of stone like unto the first, and went up into the mount, having the two tables in my hand. Verse 4, the Ten Commandments. And he wrote on the tables, according to the first writing, the Ten Commandments, which the Lord spoke unto you on the mount, out of the midst of the fire, in the day of assembly. And the Lord gave them unto me. Verse 5, and I turned and came down from the mount, and put the tables in the ark which I had made, and there they are, as the Lord commanded me. And in verse 6, he recounts the death of Aaron. And the children of Israel journey. This is a summary of 40 years of wandering. The start was Beeroth b'nei Yaakan. In the end, Moserah. These are two unknown locations. There Aaron died. There he was buried. And then the succession is mentioned. And Eleazar, his son, ministered to the priest's office in his stead. In verse 7, the journey continues. From thence they journeyed unto Gud Goda, and from Gud Goda to Yod Batha, a land of brooks of waters. And so this is a reference to Numbers 33, verses 31 through 38. And so the journey continues. And so our journey through Deuteronomy will continue next session when we get to chapter 10, verse 8. And I'm actually 2 minutes ahead of my time. So, you're dismissed.